For many, the results of November 5th confirm the view that we are in dark times. So the big question is, what are we going to do? We can wallow in self-pity and depression, or we can find kindred spirits, organize, and form alliances to not just resist the repression to come, but to promote progressive causes. As writer Rebecca Solnit says, not acting is a luxury those in immediate danger do not have, and despair something they cannot afford. But despair is all around us, telling us the problems are insoluble, that we are not strong enough, our efforts are in vain, and no one really cares. Hope, Rebecca Solnit says, counteracts cynicism and pessimism. Our guest today is Naomi Klein. She's professor in the Department of Geography at the University of British Columbia. Her writing has appeared in leading publications around the world. She's a columnist for The Guardian. She's the award-winning author of such bestsellers as No Logo, The Shock Doctrine, On Fire, and Doppelganger. She spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder at the end of October. The moderator is Professor Nabil Isha Aibi. And now, Naomi Klein.
I want to thank everybody who invited me here. It's been a long time since I've been on this wonderful campus, and it's got such a rich activist tradition, green activism and human rights and anti-war. I want to shout out the students who have been organizing and taking risks, including students who've been suspended for their activism. But I really do want to thank you for just your boldness, because courage is it really is a muscle, you know. And when we start saying, well, maybe not this week, we get used to it, and suddenly it feels like a bigger deal to just do what it is our unbelievable privilege to do: read, think, discuss, debate. How lucky are we, you know, who work at universities, whether we are on faculty or whether we're students, that this is actually our job. This is what we're doing here. This is our work. And when we voluntarily shut ourselves up, I think it's such a disservice to people who are having to do so much more difficult work and who don't have that privilege of just being asked to tell the truth for a living, for their studies. So thank you so much.
I want to start, you know, with a few questions, obviously, about the book, and congratulations on Doppelganger and the success that it's had. And there is this line in the book where you're talking about your book, The Shock Doctrine. When you shared the galleys with John Berger, the writer, he told you that that book, you know, and like what other people had told you, that the Shock Doctrine actually enraged them. He told you that it provoked and instilled in him a sense of calm. And I want to start there.
Okay.
This idea of calmness and calm as a form of resistance in times of shock and also times of chaos and confusion.
Yeah. To be clear, I don't, you know, when I say that I'm trying to bring a sense of calm, you know, to myself and to the reader, I'm not trying to make you panic. I'm not saying everything is fine. You know, I'm not saying chill out. But I do think that it is a precondition for being strategic, for making priorities, and that when we are in a state of shock, we have event without a narrative that can explain that event. And that's when we get vulnerable and become vulnerable to people who would manipulate us. I got interested in this after 9/11, watching how powerful people in this country in particular, but around the world, used the shock of 9/11 to regress us, to tell us that nothing we knew before applied. There was this phrase that some of you who are, you know, old enough to remember that period will recall, which was they would say, oh, that's pre-9/11 thinking, as if nothing you knew before mattered. And in fact, the impulse that many, many people had was to get oriented to get out of shock, and to do that together by gathering. You know, there were these spontaneous gatherings around New York City where people just got together and talked in different squares. People, you know, Noam Chomsky's book sold out, you know, because people wanted to understand, okay, why do they hate us? What happened? And in response to that, there was like, to try to understand is to betray, is to rationalize, right? You know, we heard this after October 7th as well. Anything contextualizing, right, is a thought crime. History began on October 7th. That's all that matters. And everything, you know, nothing justified October 7th, but just October 7th justifies everything. I think, you know, one of the things I noticed from immersing myself in conspiracy culture and following my doppelganger down her various rabbit holes and listening to a lot of Steve Bannon is the affect of that world is panic. It's there's always a hot new reason for you to panic. And I think that that's because when you are panicked, you are childlike. You're looking for, you know, a strong arm figure to stabilize you, protect you, right? And, you know, I'm sure we're all thinking about different people who are playing that role. So, yeah, I mean, I want us to be as calm as we can be in the storms that we are in, because I think that that's how we are at our best. But it isn't to minimize the fact that there's a hell of a lot for us to be very, very deeply and seriously concerned about. It's not the British kind of keep calm and carry on sort of thing. I absolutely do I believe in revolutionary change. I mean, I think that business as usual is catastrophic on many different fronts. For me as a writer, I'm always trying to get unpanicked and calm. I mean, all of my books are attempts to impose some kind of an order. And it's not that the world is ordered when I'm done. It's that my thoughts are ordered and I'm able to interact with the world. And I think that's what we look to nonfiction for, fiction a little bit less so, but you know, we, and I think that's what, you know, the wonderful late John Berger was saying to me. And it was so, I was so moved by it. You know, I think he was not shocked by the information in the shock doctrine. He remembered many of the events, and when he was saying he felt calm, was that it was there on the page. The shock doctrine looks at different torture techniques that deliberately discombobulate the senses, right? That this is what, you know, I look at the CIA torture manual and all the sort of sensory deprivation, confusion between day and night. You know, it's all about making us confused about where we are in time and space, because that is when a prisoner is vulnerable and less able to, defend themselves, make decisions, and when they're most likely to give up information and so on. I spent 3 days staying in Times Square in New York because I was at the New Yorker Festival, and that's where they put us up. I had never stayed in Times Square before. It's such a strange place. I'm like, why are they confusing me between day and night here? It was so hard to sleep. It's like, you people think this is fun? This is really... anyway...
Yeah, no, it's interesting. This is what you've been saying all along, is that we have to get unshocked in order to start doing the work, because to remain in a state of shock is exactly what these forces want us to remain as, right? So you mentioned 9/11, but everything else that's happening, whether it's a climate catastrophe or anything like right. that, is to maintain us in that state of shock.
Right, and shock, you know, and I say this in the shock doctrine, but that really what it is, it's not a state of shock, is not something bad happening. It's something bad happening that you don't understand yet, right? It's the gap that opens up between event and narrative that explains that event. And in that gap, we are vulnerable. And that's why we understand that and we want to fill it. Okay, what don't I know? And so there are really healthy responses, like I was describing about 9/11, and you know, the fact that Rashid Khalidi's, you know, the 100-year war on Palestine has played that role for a lot of people since October 7th. I mean, that book has gone wild for exactly this impulse. I'm filling in blanks in my education, you know, and lots of other books too. The tricky thing with our online lives, right? And you know, I wrote this book in this sort of deep in COVID lockdown, was that when we confronted a novel virus that we didn't yet understand, many of us didn't read epidemiology. Like, we went online and we just found like random health influencers. And, you know, it's the nature of the attention economy that when people follow that sort of, I think, quite healthy impulse to close the gap between event and narrative, they end up in the world of grift. And I think that that's the biggest change since I've been following shocks, is that now conspiracy is monetizable. And that was not, you know, that was not the case. Like, when I, you know, when I covered Hurricane Katrina, for instance, there were conspiracies about the levees being deliberately exploded, or there were conspiracies about 9/11. There are conspiracies, you know, I think whenever people are trying to understand, particularly when they're being taken advantage of, then they're trying to understand, okay, well, all these people are getting rich off of my misery. Maybe they did it on purpose. But nobody was getting rich off of that, you know? I mean, maybe the guys who made Loose Change, but like, it was just, it was a much more kind of human scale problem. Whereas now, part of what I've called the disaster capitalism complex is the dissemination of misinformation, because that information is going to get you the maximum traction when people are panicked, right? So we saw it just recently during Hurricane Helene. What is happening? This is not a part of the country that is supposed to be hit, right? If we're thinking about, you know, Asheville or these mountainous parts, which actually saw themselves as climate refuges, right? They were supposed to be some of the least impacted areas. Suddenly, homes are floating down the street. And, you know, into that breach, into that gap come, well, maybe the government is controlling the weather, right? Maybe they're after the lithium, maybe they're after, you know, and it becomes this kind of tornado of misinformation, much of it contradictory. And this is the point that I get into in the section of the book called The Conspiracy is Capitalism, which is that really, if you think about who benefits from that, we're not talking about the conspiracies we know about. You know, I know there's some great climate scientists here and people who, you know, we actually know that Exxon and all the other big oil companies have been deliberately spreading misinformation about climate. We know their own climate scientists back to the 1970s understood incredibly well not only the connection between their core product and warming, but their models were incredibly accurate. We know this through peer-reviewed science. That's a pretty consequential conspiracy. But while we're talking about the, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene version, or maybe people aren't being saved because the migrants got the money, well, that it actually benefits elites. So the posture is we're taking on the elites, but of course the people who are so happy to spread it are some of the richest people on the planet, like Elon Musk, who's a one-man conspiracy himself, right? So, I mean, it's an elite protection racket, this whole monetized conspiracy world, if that makes sense.
I'm interested in the sort of distinction that you make about conspiracy culture versus conspiracy theory. I mean, I think you say that we should pay very close attention to the fact that we're no longer dealing with the conspiracy theories of, you know, a decade ago or two decades, but we should be really paying attention to this new culture. And if you could say a little bit more about the danger and the risks that we're running because of the fact that we went from conspiracy theory into conspiracy culture.
It's important to me that we recognize that there are real conspiracies in the world. You know, Adam Smith said, you know, rarely do people from the same industry get together in private that it doesn't end up in some form of price fixing, right? It's not mysterious. It's not as salacious as the kind of QAnon version of like, oh, they're trying to drain the adrenochrome from these kids to live forever. It's just kind of capitalism doing its thing. And usually it does it in public, but sometimes it does it in private. And, you know, the shock doctrine was a history of the uses of shocks, coup d'etats, dirty tricks, in order to impose neoliberal economics, which we were then told, you know, spread around the world through freedom and light. And it's also true that left-wing analysts and researchers often get called conspiracy theorists as a way to dismiss them, right? So I don't call these folks conspiracy theorists. I call them conspiracy influencers or conspiracy fantasists, just because I have too much respect for theory to do that, you know? And there isn't really a theory. It's sometimes called conspiracy without a theory. And because it is so much a part of the attention economy and so much about getting the clicks, the theories often wildly contradict one another. So we saw this during COVID, like, you know, early days where it was all about the masks. Don't mask, it's just a cold, right? But then it was like, no, it's a bioweapon. And then it was like, no, the vaccine is the bioweapon. It's like, but nobody ever tried to resolve these different conspiracies. They were just kind of like, they would just match every phase of what people were talking about. And then a new conspiracy, a new story really would emerge that was going to ride that wave, right? Kind of clout chasing, really. I think that we end up not talking about the conspiracies that are right in front of us, because there was a huge amount of very real disaster profiteering during the pandemic. We saw, you know, the world's 10 richest people double their wealth. We saw tech companies taking advantage of remote schooling in order to push their products. We saw vaccines, which frankly, I don't think should have ever been patented in the first place because they were developed with public funds. It was, you know, it was a fee-for-service arrangement with our governments. Why was so much wealth made off of these vaccines? And we also saw vaccine hoarding in the global north. So there were many things that we could have been talking about instead of talking about whether Bill Gates is trying to inject something to track you, you know, and, you know, instead of whether or not this was like a plot to make women infertile or whatever. And this is the kind of thing that my doppelganger, Naomi Wolf, was at the center of, which is why she became kind of an interesting sort of, you know, I call her like the white rabbit that led me down the rabbit hole. She's not the subject of the book, but she's a major player in the world of medical misinformation and disinformation. There was a study that found that she was sort of ground zero of the vaccine shedding myth, the idea that people who were vaccinated were shedding their vaccine particles onto unvaccinated people, and it was causing them to, you know, maybe be infertile or affecting their periods and things like that. That was one of her big things. And like you talked about the facts wrong and the feelings right. She really had her breakthrough when she started saying that the vaccine verification apps that we all had on our phones were actually listening in on our phone conversations and listening in on our conversations in person, and were part of a plan to bring a Chinese-style social credit system to the United States. So once she said this, then suddenly she's on Tucker Carlson, she's on Steve Bannon's show every day. And what I realized was that she was wrong about the facts of this. Like, these vaccine verification apps were not eavesdropping on our conversations. They weren't surveillance devices. But, you know, the response from, like, liberal Twitter was this really kind of snide, like, well, wait till they hear about cell phones, right? Which I found really interesting because it speaks to the fact that we all are incredibly uneasy about the fact that we live in a surveillance state and that we don't know what our phones are doing with our data, and we all have had that weird experience, like, it's my phone listening to me? What is going on right now? But we're not actually doing anything about it, right? And the Democrats aren't doing anything about it, even though they sort of said that they were going to, right? And so the response to this misinformation about the vaccine verification apps is like, well, we, you know, world-weary people understand that it's really just our cell phones that are doing all of those things, right? But why are we okay with that, right? And so if we've somehow normalized this level of surveillance, then of course Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson are going to tap into the fact that people have very strong feelings about surveillance, as well we should. We should all be very worried about it. We should look for real solutions to it. We shouldn't project all of it onto a vaccine verification app. There are real questions about those apps, by the way. Like, any time you... you know, digitize life further and, you know, make people have to have cell phones, you know, you are restricting who's going to have access to these spaces. I'm not a big fan of it. But I was really struck that they were projecting all of our collective fears about surveillance onto these one apps, and they were getting the facts wrong, but they were getting the feelings right. And they're only able to do that if we are no longer addressing those surveillance fears. So this is what really has interested me about and scared me and chilled me about studying the Bannon right, if you will, or the MAGA right, is that I see them doing a kind of mix and match with a lot of issues that used to very much be issues of the left, you know, in particular, the issues that I came up in, right? I wrote a book called No Logo. I was part of the ultra-globalization movement that was very much focused on corporate power, corporate control of the media, the fact that just a handful of companies were consolidating in every single industry. And we no longer really have a left that is squarely focused on that, right? And this is the thing about Bannon, is he always looks at the issues that we have abandoned, and he takes it and then he mixes and matches it with xenophobia, with racism, you know, and he makes this like Frankenstein kind of cocktail doppelganger of the left. And he did it with free trade in 2016. And now he's doing it with, you know, big media, big pharma. So those were the moments when I felt really disconcerted in my research, was when I'd be listening to Bannon and he'd sound a little like me and Bernie, you know, and Amy Goodman, you know, where he be. And so, and then I would go, well, are we still talking about this? I'm not sure we're talking about it with the same kind of focus. You know, yes, we must speak, but we also have to reunite our words with action, because I think a lot of what is happening with the backlash against the Democrats and against the left generally is just this feeling of like, these are people that just perform their politics, they talk down to people, but they're all a bunch of hypocrites because they don't actually match it with action. You know, where we see the veil pierced sometimes and a possible a glimpse of another kind of politics is when, you know, somebody like Sean Fain, who's head of the, you know, the auto workers union, talks about, you know, eating the rich, and, you know, his Eat the Rich t-shirt, and comes out and says, you know, we're gonna get a new contract for auto workers, and you know, record profits mean record wages. And so he's not just posturing, he's not just, you know, wearing an Eat the Rich gown. I mean, he's actually talking about getting a share of the profits, right? And that's the kind of thing Trump doesn't want to deal with. That's the kind of thing that Bannon doesn't want to deal with, which is why he didn't want Trump to run against Bernie, because there's a lot of artifice going on, but there's also a lot of artifice going on in the Democratic Party. So, like when I watched the RNC from start to finish, everyone's like, "Why did you do that?" Because you got to watch these folks, you know. But it's amazing because it's like this mashup of everything that is just sort of defiantly fake, right? It's just like it's beauty pageants and pro wrestling and stadium rock and reality television and all these things that are like they're not pretending to be real, and everyone's kind of in on it, and it's just dialed up to like a million, and so we all understand like that's fake, you know. But then you look at the DNC and it's like, is this prestige TV? Like, what is this? This is like Coach Walls is kind of like Ted Lasso, you know, and then, you know, Kamala Harris is like the lovable police chief in every procedural drama you've ever seen, right? But it's like nobody's really actually engaging with reality, right? I mean, if you're saying, yeah, we believe climate change is real, but let's please have much more fracking, right? So I'm not saying that they're equivalent, but I'm saying that when you aren't actually willing to get real about where we are, you're leaving a door wide open for people who come in with a, you know, a defiantly fake message. But the part of their project that's real is the hate. That's what they can deliver on. They can deliver on the dominance. They can deliver on, you can have control over your kids again and your wife again and, you know, the border again. And, you know, that stuff's cheap.
And it feels like the other side is just doing reactive politics, right? Sort of, we're not doing it. You have this line, this incredible line on page 152 about your friend Bill McKibben, the author of The End of Nature, talking about the futility of words. And you say, quote, "What if our books, our movements, as they are currently constructed, often in ways that resemble brands, are only changing words? What if words written on the page or shouted in protest change only what people and institutions say and not what they do?" I mean, this is clearly, as you just described, is the risk that we're facing, but are we all suffering from what Greta Thunberg says, blah, blah, blah? I mean, is that what we could all be accused of?
I think so. Before I go to that, but you know, I do believe that Greta's blah, blah, blah speech was one of the greatest sort of political interventions of all time. It was really interesting. You know, I think it was 2022. The UN Climate Summit was in Glasgow. And up to that point, Greta had played a very particular role in the culture, which is, you know, she would be invited to these conferences and to these elite gatherings like Davos, and she would come and she would be invited to scold people, right? To plead with people, to say, "How dare you? How dare you do this to our future?" And then they would all take selfies with her, you know, "Do it again, please," you know, and fist bump her and all of this. And it's very clear that she got sick of it. And this is the last time she's gone to a COP. She has stopped going. And she goes to Glasgow, and every microphone that gets put in front of her, she just says, they're here to do the blah, 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 green economy, blah, 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 build back better, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, they have an agreement. They even managed to water down the blah, 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 which is quite an accomplishment. That was her statement. And then she went and got arrested trying to stop a coal plant. And she also has been very outspoken on Palestine. And she has said very clearly that these are not separate issues. You know, and I think this is true for so many young climate activists, that the motivation for getting involved in climate justice is about valuing life, human and other than human. But anything that treats life as disposable must be resisted at all costs. So, of course, if there is a genocide happening, and there is a genocide happening in Gaza, then, of course, you must stand up and say no. Because if that level of atrocity is normalized, anything is possible, which is why Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, the country, not the university, said the Global South sees their future in Gaza. If this becomes normalized, if this is acceptable, if it becomes ambient to our lives, to quote Jonathan Glazer, who made Zone of Interest, then this will be the future on every border. And, you know, this is, you know, why I say that the Iron Dome is global. You know, if we want to understand why our governments are lining up across party lines around the global north to support Israel, it's because our governments are invested in protecting the same levels of injustice and inequality at our borders, often with the same technologies. There's a rupture that is happening with the blah, blah, blah on our campuses. And this is why I thank you, you know, really profoundly for speaking, because honestly, we can't take it for granted. I've been on a little mini campus tour and been staggered by some of the silence that I've encountered, by the self-censorship that I've encountered. And I think for so many young people who go to universities that do land acknowledgements, that talk about EDI, that celebrate young people for being climate activists, standing up for human rights, but then when they stood up against genocide in Gaza, had the police called on them or at Homeland Security and are suddenly being treated like the enemy within, it's not just Donald Trump, it breeds a profound cynicism and loss of faith, right? And so what I see happening with this generation is really trying to have the rhetoric mean something, not to throw out the rhetoric, but to say, okay, guys, we're being tested. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Not what are we going to say, but what are we going to do? Are we going to divest? Are we going to not let weapons companies recruit on our campus? Like, what are we going to do materially that we can do? And we have to do it.
You're listening to Naomi Klein. What are we going to do? This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program and for her Doppelganger book, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
I wanted to ask you about how the figure of the doppelganger helps you get to all of these conclusions and also issue these warnings about what's going on. I'm just curious about how your story about Wolf is not a specific story. It's not a personal story. It's actually a story about how it is also a universal story. It's about how societies and countries have become doppelgangers of themselves. Right, whether it's Israel, whether it's the United States, whether it's, you know, or any other society. Yeah. And you say on page 274, what if the full-blown fascism is not the monster at the door, but the monster inside the house, the monster inside of us? Right? This is the biggest danger, right? Sort of, we follow you in the story about Wolf, but we shouldn't really just stay there, obviously.
What I realized was that having a doppelganger was a sort of, my friend Keo McClear, who's a wonderful writer, talked about it as a narrow aperture that could let me look at a few different things. I'd wanted to return to the subject of personal branding, for instance, because a brand is kind of a double that we make of ourselves, right? My first book was about branding, but it came out, you know, in 2000, And it was pre-iPhone, it was pre-social media. It was not yet possible for all of us to be brands. I mean, when I wrote No Logo, Michael Jordan was a brand, but, you know, English professors were not brands, you know? But suddenly we all ended up with advertising companies in our back pockets, and they told us it was free. They didn't tell us they were going to hoover up all the data and make doppelgangers of us using AI, but that's a whole other story, right? So what I realized is, oh, this is interesting. I have a branding problem. There's another Naomi who people think is me, and she's doing all kinds of wild things, and people keep screaming at me on the internet about it. But then I'm like, well, is that me on the internet, or is that a doppelganger of me, and who are any of us? And this was like, you know, deep pandemic thinking. And so I realized I could get back at this subject, but not do it from the outside, kind of do it from the inside, right, where we're all implicated, right? It's easy to be like, oh, you are the brand, and I am a true human. But we're all of none of our choosing, all trying to kind of get by. And I think the impulse to perfect the self is really an impulse really to survive when so much security has been stripped away in this economic model. We're trying to build our little branded lifeboats, right? So part of how I mapped this was by reading a lot of books about doppelgangers and watching a lot of films about doppelgangers and this and calling it research. So, you know, I read Dostoevsky, the Double, and Saramago, and watch Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, and a lot of Jordan Peele. And, you know, what you realize is that many artists have used the figure of the doppelganger to explore fascism, to explore this feeling of, like, you know, Freud talked about how we're drawn to the doppelganger because the doppelganger stands in for the lives we might have lived, right? Like, we know that even though we live in a system that tells us that we are all, you know, authors of our own destiny and responsible for all of our successes, you know, that our lives could be so different. The person we are is not the result just of our own actions. It's the result of these accidents of birth and decisions that our parents and grandparents made and the systems we were born into and the privileges and the lack thereof that bestowed on us. So this idea that there's another you walking around that other people think are you stands in for this feeling of, like, is there, like, could I be someone else, right? And also, like, could I be someone worse? Am I not the person who I think I am? And so the reason why I say it's, you know, it can't just be about her is that one of the things I learned from reading a lot of doppelganger literature is that often the stories follow a certain arc where, like, somebody realizes there's another them walking around and they just go off on a self-righteous journey to confront their doppelganger and perhaps kill them. And this invariably leads to the protagonist being dead on the ground because the doppelganger is always them. Like, the doppelganger is you. It's holding up a mirror going, do you like what you see? You can't stab your doppelganger, even if you would like to. You have to actually see what your doppelganger is showing you, parts of yourself that you don't want to see. Like, you know, there's so much talk of fascism in the moment that we're in. Is he or isn't he? That this should be a moment where we really look at ways in not just that they are acting like fascists, but that we might be.
You know, you mentioned Walter Benjamin's famous line of every document of civilization is necessarily and always a document of barbarism. And also, you know, Aimé Césaire, who said very eloquently, he said that colonialism, modernity, and fascism are all just a snaking old story, right? It's like these are things that are happening. We are not better than other people. We're not better than other cultures. We think that we are, and we want to teach them all kinds of lessons, but we should also check in the fascism at the door.
I think this was the part of the research that was most important for me personally, and that has been most orienting in terms of understanding the moment. You know, the book came out a month before October 7th, you know, and that has helped me sort of understand the rise of the far right globally, helped me to understand the ways in which people I know and grew up with are rationalizing atrocities right now. And that is, you quoted Cesar and Benjamin. I went to a Jewish day school. I thought I understood what the Holocaust was and what fascism was. It turns out I was not exposed to a huge body of literature that, and And neither was almost anyone I know, which is embarrassing, you know, including my parents who are lefties, you know. But all of these anti-colonial thinkers in the 30s and 40s were saying about the rise of fascism in Europe that this is not new. This is not a rupture. This is imperialism, colonialism, boomeranging, in Cesare's words, back to Europe. Now, I know there are many scholars in this room who are familiar with this literature. I was not. The literature I grew up with was the Holocaust was a rupture in time and space. Once again, a shock without history. In fact, to compare it with any other genocide was anti-Semitic. There was, you know, in the words of Claude Lanzmann, a ring of fire around the Holocaust. And so even like to do any, like he was talking about filmmaking, but you can't go into it. You can't understand it. Like that there was a forbidding. In fact, Lanzmann used this sentence to describe Claude Lanzmann made this landmark documentary series called Shoah, which was how a lot of people learned about the Holocaust. It was 9.5 hours. And Lanzmann was a contemporary of Sartre, a colleague, and de Beauvoir. He was in the French Resistance. He made this landmark film. But this was a really, really key part of how he explained the Holocaust to the world. Use this phrase, here there is no why. Here there is no why about Auschwitz and about the Holocaust. The phrase comes from Primo Levi, who was in Auschwitz, and he was quoting a guard saying, here there is no why. So if anyone is asking why they're there, and the answer was, here there is no why. So a guard's answer to a prisoner becomes why we're not allowed to say why. How can we compare? How did it happen? So W.E.B. Du Bois, Cesare, Benjamin, later Arendt, many others were trying to understand the lineages of European fascism. And the lineages are in settler colonialism here. Hitler was very open about what he learned from the Jim Crow South, from eugenics here. You know, the whole idea of Lebensraum expanding, getting elbow room to the east, was built on the Western frontier. I mean, it was an expansion of that, but also the genocide, the German genocide of the Nama and Herero in what is now Namibia. After the First World War, Germany lost its colonies, including in Africa, and so decided to expand eastward, right? So there are all of these, like, not wavy lines, but straight lines from colonialism in the global south and settler colonialism here and in Australia and Canada. And it was not part of our Holocaust education, which means we don't know. I mean, we watch all these interviews. Is he a fascist? People do not know what fascism is. They're acting as if it has to be a replica of Hitler and Mussolini, as opposed to something that is deeply encoded in our histories, right? That has always been here. Even this idea, could it happen here? It never happened here. It happened here. It happened here. It happened. And so if we don't understand that fascism, it has always been our twin, right? And this is what Jordan Peele is trying to show us with all the doubles. Then how will we recognize it? Doppelgangers help.
Very much so. I want to get to Palestine and Israel. October 7 was a terrible day, no matter which way you look at things. But when I see the reaction to October 7, or what preceded October 7, the dehumanization, the decontextualization, the banalization of suffering, the use of divine prophecy to call some children children of light, and others children of darkness, unleashing the worst military power on civilians, this license to kill, maim, erase, evict, and disregard international law, the suppression of speech, the denial of Palestinian tears and grief, and the callous indifference and direct support of our government. How do we ever reach a resolution when this level of toxic doubling of the ethnic other is happening?
Well, thank you for that. How do we do it? I mean, I think partly, you know, what I was saying before about how we respond to this moment, how we meet this moment. first we do have to look, and I know a lot of people have, you know, it becomes too much and you look away. And if you are one of those people who've stopped looking, I would really implore you to look. I mean, I don't think we need to be marinating in the images all the time, but I think we can go to trusted sources. Good journalism. I think The Guardian's been doing some very good reporting. I think Al Jazeera's been doing some very good reporting. And understand that we are in a new phase right now where those early statements of intent that form part of South Africa's genocide case before the ICJ, quoting all of these Israeli officials saying what they plan to do in Gaza, is now happening in northern Gaza right now. And more than a million people are at risk of starvation. All of the hospitals are under attack, are not functioning. And so I hope people do look and think about what we're called to do. There is no justification for genocide. It's why we have a genocide convention. We can't hide behind, well, they did that and they want to do this. It doesn't matter. There is no justification for genocide. This is how a culture is erased. It is very, very deliberate, and it's happening before our eyes. So this is why what we do now really matters. It also matters how we treat each other. You know, I think that there are some things we can control and there's some things we can't control. You know, there are things that we can demand of our government in terms of a weapons embargo. I mean, this has to be the number one demand, is to stop arming the state. It's your taxpayers, it's your weapons, your tax dollars and your weapons, all of ours, really. I'm an American as well. But then I also think that we have to model another way to be with one another, you know, in our movements, in our social movements. You know, and as a Jewish person who, I'm part of an anti-war movement, I'm part of a, you know, movement against apartheid, occupation. I've been on the board of Jewish Voice for Peace for 15 years. And the way I see the work with Jewish Voice for Peace is partly a response to, you know, what I see as, you know, sometimes called Judeo-pessimism, similar to Afro-pessimism, right? This idea that Jew hatred is eternal, primordial, and so powerful that you can't respond to it with any of the usual tools. We're never going to be free of these hatreds, but there are things that we can do in terms of actually respecting universal human rights and commitments to equality before the law and real solidarity in ways that we can show up for one another that can mitigate them in very serious ways, right? And I really do believe in that multiracial, multi-ethnic alliance. And that's a big part of the Jewish tradition, particularly before the Holocaust. And after the Holocaust, many of the people who were part of fighting for those multi-ethnic futures were annihilated. But, you know, they were annihilated in the Holocaust. They were not annihilated in Stalin's camps. And so it sort of seemed like Zionism was the only possible response left, an ethnostate. So I don't believe in that ethnostate, and I believe it was always leading to this moment. But when I say that, that also means that I need to be fighting for Jews to be safe here, right? Because a big part of Zionism's argument is that you need an ethnostate because Jews will never be safe. There will always be another Holocaust around the corner, right? And so I think really fighting for one another and really committing ourselves to one another's, you know, our mutual liberation and safety is part of fighting that here, right? So I think, what can we control? We can fight to stop sending the weapons. We can divest. And we can model what it means to fight hatred, all forms of hatred, anti-Palestinian hatred, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, anti-Black racism, all of it, right, in coalition with one another, and build real cultures of care. And that's really hard work. It's really hard work during a genocide. And I think it might be even more important in those moments when it's hard.
So Q&A, who has a question?
Great. Hi, thank you. I have a question about related and different, relating to sort of the shock doctrine, in light of a lot of the news coming out of what happened post-Helene with the disinformation and Russian hackers. And I'm curious just your thoughts in general about the sort of new political disinformation doppelganger, how the two relate for you. but also putting it into the lens of the way you were just speaking about Gaza, of what can we do and what should we do? Because I think what can we do is looking at the Russian framework and outside actors, but I'm curious into your thoughts of sort of the relational, what should we do? Thank you.
I think there are a lot of different players, and the fact that Elon Musk is, fired all the content moderators and wants to amplify, is personally amplifying this, is, you know, that's a domestic problem, you know, that he was allowed to buy Twitter in the first place, and that this is so deregulated, you know, to the degree that, you know, when he bought Twitter, he said it, he wanted it because it was the global town square, right? So I think we need to start thinking about what it means to have an information commons. You know, this really is a public good, and it needs to be treated and regulated as such. And it's simply, you know, wild that one person could just buy it and turn it into their plaything and amplify disinformation. You know, he amplified the, you know, the FEMA spending money on migrants lie. But also, I mean, what we need to do is not give in to this sort of like, oh, they like they're the crazy people, we know everything is fine, you know, because everything is not fine. We need to talk about climate change, and we need to talk about what we're going to do in the face of climate change, and we need to talk about the conspiracies that are peer-reviewed and that we can prove and that we know about, including the fact that Trump brought, you know, I think it was 10 oil executives to Mar-a-Lago and promised them if they gave him $1 billion, he would roll back Biden's entire environmental agenda. You know, that's kind of conspiratorial, you know? It's just normalized conspiracy. So we need to kind of denormalize that because it should not be allowed. So I think this brings us to like what, you know, what are the priorities? Money in politics, I think having an actual like healthy information ecology, investing in reliable media is important, you know, various kinds. So
we live in a democracy. We believe in the idea that we can vote and we can elect people into power. We want to talk about, like, you know, functional media, etc. But we don't live in any of that right now. And we're watching infrastructures that were backstops come undone. And so one of the things I'm curious about is, as you're thinking about this, how do we get past, like, it would be great if we had functioning media. It would be great if we had functioning Congress. And where are, in your mind, some of the more tactical things that can be done, as we're not just seeing the challenges that are the big screen TV challenges, but the genuine infrastructural erosion challenges?
I think different things are possible depending on different electoral outcomes. I'm not sure I know exactly how to fix America right now. I know that it says that I'm going to get you back to stable ground, but I mean, we are pretty far gone. Like, we're pretty deep in the rubble. You know, this is why, you know, that Walter Benjamin quote, I mean, it really is, it's about the angel of history, and it's about the fact that it's cumulative, right? I mean, our defeats add up, and we don't get to the blank sheet where we're just like, make everything perfect. We need to build power, and I don't think there are any shortcuts to that. And really, building institutional power, whether it's trade unions or organizations that are membership-based that we can rely on in these moments. Be suspicious when you see things online that seem to all be about tearing down the few institutions that we have left. Ask who would benefit if we had nothing we could rely on. You know, I was very active in the Bernie campaign, but I recognized that we were kind of skipping some phases of just kind of going straight for the presidency before we had really done that kind of ground up building. So I think that there are some exciting things that are happening with union organizing across the country, and we need to use our collective voices as much as we can.
I am a student here at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and I'm also like a pretty engaged in the student and community activism movements here, first in the climate movement and right now in the Palestine movement. And I'm actually like currently working with a couple of the students that were suspended recently too. And so as a veteran activist and organizer in a lot of these spaces, and who's written a lot about like of these groups that have faced oncoming repression, what kind of advice do you think you could give to students that are active in organizing here to create and promote that kind of progressive change?
That's a great question, and thanks for your organizing. I think there's strength in numbers. having alliances that are intergenerational is also important. Some of the sturdiest activism that we've seen in this period are in places where students and undergrads and graduate students and faculty members have organized together and, you know, won some significant victories, even if not enough. I mean, I was recently at Cornell where a graduate student, Mamadou Tal, I don't know if he was completely suspended, but to the extent that he was going to be deported. And there was a huge petition. I think 10,000 people signed it. And they had to re-enroll him so that he wasn't going to be deported. So now he can stay and finish his PhD. So, I mean, it does show that despite the fact that these universities are very, very fearful, in particular, you know, they're afraid of donors, they're afraid of Congress, you know, people can organize and they can also be a force on campus that administrators have to respond to, right? This is just organized power that they are afraid of, and we need to be organized as well. That often does mean that not everybody is going to agree, right? And, you know, one of the ways that I look in the mirror and I'm concerned about what I see on our side is I really feel like we've lost the knack of debate within our ranks. Like, there's often a just kind of like, you know, this is like a maximalist position and everyone has to take that on, or they're not even worth engaging in. Then you end up with a small movement. I'm sorry, you know. I think we need to create on-ramps where people can get involved without already agreeing on everything, you know? This is something we do on the left. We didn't know it last week, but now we know it, and no one's allowed in who doesn't already know it. You know, this is like one of the things that I really love about, like, the film Israelism. I like it because it shows people changing their mind. It shows people who used to believe one thing, and now they learned other things. Now they believe something else. It's not the only film we should be seeing. We should be seeing lots of films from a Palestinian perspective. But being able to see people change their minds in public, people change at university. It's one of the great things about universities. We get exposed to new worldviews and we change our worldview. But how do we do that, right? How do we do that in a way that is loving? And, you know, not everybody needs to play that role educating a newbie. For some people, that's going to be a lot more painful than others. But, you know, we need to organize so that there are people who do that work, right? So, yeah, like, what are the on-ramps? You know, what are the first steps? How do we create welcoming cultures that replenish us? Because it's hard, you know, it's hard. People are taking real risks. We need to actually even have fun. I know it sounds crazy, but I actually believe that as organizers, we need to create opportunities where we, like, cook together, have a nice time together, heal each other, like, feel what we're actually feeling, create, like, soft spaces where you can actually talk and not yell into the void, you know, of social media. All those things help, like, where it's like, well, imagine, like, building a movement where, like, it would be, like, somewhere that we would want to spend time. And I've seen some of that, but I've also seen the opposite, like, really kind of punishing activist cultures. And I also get that because people are in so much goddamn pain, which is really understandable. And it often happens that when you're in pain, you just look to, like, have an effect on the people who you can hurt, which is not your university administrator, but is, like, probably somebody you're friends with. These are, like, my little pearls of wisdom from, you know, 30 years of activism. Be a little bit nicer to each other if you can. Thank you so much.
You were just listening to Naomi Klein, What Are We Going to Do? She spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder at the end of October. Naomi Klein is a professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Her writing has appeared in leading publications around the world. She's a columnist for The Guardian. She's the award-winning author of such bestsellers as This Changes Everything, No Logo, On Fire, and her latest book, Doppelganger. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. And we have a series of Naomi Klein programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Naomi Klein, What Are We Going to Do?, and for her doppelganger book, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Tim Butler. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Alicia Keys singing Bob Dylan's Pressing On.
I'm pressing on.
Kids to grow up safe and healthy. So we show them how, and we tell them, with honest conversations that let them know what we expect. That's especially important when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. Kids need to know the dangers and how to avoid them. And when it comes to pain medications, opioids, they need to know that they should never be taken without a prescription and never shared with friends or family. It's dangerous and illegal. So talk with your kids, because when you talk, they hear you.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at how artificial intelligence and democracy are colliding in ways that could either strengthen self-government or quietly undermine it.
Our guest, Nathan E. Sanders, co-author of Rewiring Democracy, will explore how AI is already shaping politics, governance, and civic life.
The Constitution was built on a simple idea: divide power or lose liberty. But our own Steve Rohde argues that those guardrails are being dismantled in real time.
In my recent article, The Unitary Presidency, I warn that an aggressive theory of executive power, enabled by the Supreme Court's shadow docket, is systematically consolidating authority in the White House and redefining American democracy.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
Artificial intelligence and democracy are two of the most charged words in the news right now. To hear the headlines tell it, AI is either about to save us or quietly break everything that makes self-government possible. A new book refuses that false choice. It asks a more uncomfortable and more political question: who is using AI, how, and for whose benefit? The book is Rewiring Democracy: How AI Will Transform Our Politics, Government, and Citizenship, published by MIT Press. It starts from a deceptively simple idea. Democracy is an information processing system, one that gathers people's preferences and turns them into law, policy, and power. Instead of treating AI as a distant sci-fi threat, Rewiring Democracy looks at what's already happening: AI in lawmaking, courts, elections, public services, and everyday citizenship. And it asks the question too often left out of the debate: not what the technology can do, but who controls it and who is left out. Joining us today is Nathan E. Sanders, a data scientist affiliated with Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. His work focuses on using technology to strengthen democratic participation, especially for communities historically excluded from decision-making. He's the co-author of Rewiring Democracy, along with cybersecurity expert Bruce Schneier. Nathan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much. Fantastic to be with you.
You and Bruce Schneier began writing together around 2020, when many of the political uses of AI still felt hypothetical. As you worked, what surprised you most about how fast those what-ifs became real-world political tools?
You're exactly right. When we started work on this subject, it was years before large language models were in the common parlance. It was years before ChatGPT was released. And to be frank with you, a lot of the feedback that we got from academic journal reviewers is that the applications of AI to politics and to policymaking that we were talking about felt unrealistic or outlandish. And it does feel 5 years later like there are real examples of those types of interventions leveraging AI happening in democratic systems all around the world. For me, the kind of wake-up moment was within just a few weeks of when ChatGPT was released. Bruce and I had just authored at that time an op-ed for the New York Times talking about the ways that lobbyists might use AI to supercharge their influence of political systems. And the Times, I think for the first time, published a response to our op-ed that was authored by ChatGPT. And that felt like a moment where it felt very real and very visible for everybody around the world that AI was now part of political processes.
Nathan, one of your most interesting core arguments is that AI isn't inherently democratic or authoritarian. It amplifies whatever power structures already exist. Can you expand on that for our listeners? Why are governance, ownership, and control more consequential than the technical breakthroughs themselves?
I do think that's right. We see AI as a power-amplifying technology. And our democratic systems have many actors within them. We have politicians vying for office. We have elected officials who are using their power in those seats of power. We have individual citizens and advocacy organizations fighting for what they believe in. And we can already see all those actors in political systems leveraging AI to amplify their own power, which is entirely natural in how all other technologies get distributed across these political systems. Now, there